Hey everyone out in podcast land, this is Alex Lokes and we are into October. Yes, the colors are changing, snow is on its way, winter is indeed coming, and just in time for winter, we have decided to take cameras that really should stay in the studio, but we're taking them out in the field. That's right, we are authorizing these studio cameras for field use.
Coming to you live from Toronto, Canada, this is the Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to our show.
Okay, so the first type of camera that you really think of being in the studio are large format view cameras. And while there are several types of 4x5 and 8x10 cameras that can come out into the field, most of the times you think of monorail cameras as being in the field. Now, two of our hosts are well known for their love of monorail cameras and their craziness in bringing them out into the field, and that's Mike and Donna. So, Mike and Donna, what does it take to bring a monorail camera out into the field, and why do you put yourself through this pain and torture?
Okay, bringing a monorail out to the field probably wouldn't hurt to have a mule. That's usually step number one. Depending on the size of the monorail.
Sorry, can I ask which one of you is the mule?
Michael is.
Figured.
Although I've been replaced by a little red buggy, so it's a bonus. But yeah, I'd highly recommend having some kind of wheeled transportation to get a large monorail, especially like an 8x10, through a field. I mean, I didn't like carrying it when we took it out just to a cemetery just to do shooting, and I was walking around with the tripod and the bloody monorail on my shoulder. It got heavy. Plus, I also had my own monorail that day too, which was not fun. No, that's right. I only had a Bronica, so which wasn't that much lighter, but still. But if we go with the smaller 4x5s, you can get lighter ones like the more basic ones, such as like the Calumet or Orbit. They're pretty basic. They're fairly light. There's also the Graphic View, which is also fairly light. But as you start to get more elaborate, such as the Cambo SC or something like that, which more movements, it's a lot
or
heavier.
Or a CNRF.
Or a CNRF, yep. They can start to get a little bit heavy and a little bit prohibitive, especially taking it out in the field. But a lot of time with what you can do with one, you can get a heck of a lot of, you can get a lot of movements, so you can isolate subjects very easily. Even if you're stopping down to f16, f22, f32 on your lens, you can still, just by shifting your focal plane from changing your front standard and rear standard, you can just completely isolate a subject from everything else. So using a monorail in the field, it's a challenge, but it's definitely a worthwhile challenge.
I'd recommend taking it out if you want to do landscapes or portraits. Landscapes, you can't get a better picture other than, you know, using your monorail, just because it's so big and you get the full capture in the picture. That's what I use mine for, basically, is for landscapes or for portraits, and the pictures is just phenomenal.
So where did you get the idea of picking up the little red buggy?
Well, the little red buggy, it was funny because I was just thinking to myself, there's got to be an easier way, especially if it's one thing if you're walking around just in a small open field, it's one thing, just pick it up, walk to another spot. But if you're going up hills or rugged, or not so much rugged terrain, but just moving around in a large area, you want something to be more portable. So getting the little buggy was a huge thing. I mean, we looked at a wagon, but unfortunately the wagons were non-collapsible. But then we came across a collapsible wagon. I thought, oh, well, this might be interesting.
And for an 8x10, it worked out fantastic.
Nice. Yeah, I remember back in August when we did the large format lugabout in High Park, and that's only 2 kilometers from where we started at Colburn Lodge up to Bloor Street. And there are a lot of hills there, and when the 8x10 is larger than you, Donna, that was actually pretty an impressive feat, and the results you got out were absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, now the nice thing about using a monorail as opposed to, say, a field camera or a press camera is especially relevant if you're doing architectural work. So if you're shooting a building and you want straight verticals, the nice thing about adjusting your focal plane is you can keep all verticals completely straight and level, which
absolutely
any front other rise. Camera, you're not going to be able to.
Front rise is really the only movement I use. Well, it's also one of the only movements I have accessible to me with my Crown Graphic. But it certainly is handy.
It is.
Because during that walk in August, there was a couple on a hill, and I really, really wanted to completely isolate the subject. So when I focused on them, I tilted my front standard and rear standard so that everything above them, everything behind them, everything in front of them, and everything below them would be completely knocked out of focus. But then I had this fine line that went across that was in focus. So by adding a little bit of swing to the front and back, it was basically just a small pocket of focus right where they are, and everything else is just completely out. And honestly, you can't do that with any other camera but a monorail.
That's right. Absolutely. Well, they are the cheapest of all the 4x5s out there. That makes it a great place to start. So even though they can be a bit awkward in the field, definitely worthwhile if you really want to get into large format.
At least try it. If you haven't tried it, try it at least one time.
I've had a chance to shoot two monorail cameras, one of them being a Cynar F2, and just an absolute joy to shoot, but a pain to set up and take down. Absolutely.
Yeah, and some of the more advanced ones, at least they can completely come apart, so they become compact while packing them up. But the lesser expensive ones, such as like the Orbit or the Calumet, the rail is not removable. So it's basically you've got front, rear standards and the bellows plus the rail all one shot, and that's the only way to transport it. And usually you end up with a really big, heavy case. It's sort of like a toolbox, only it's extremely heavy, and it's usually made out of metal.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Although you could probably get a Pelican case that can
hold
it as well.
So. That was actually...
With wheels.
And that was actually one of the really driving forces about getting a wagon or something like that, was her Pelican case. It has wheels. It's really easy to transport. But that would mean we'd have to break it down and collapse it every single time
in between shots. Again, you can leave it up.
Yeah. Perfect. Take the monorail off the tripod, put it in the wagon, put the tripod in the wagon with the holders, and away you go.
Oh, wait. Nice. Well, speaking of large format, also in August, Bill Smith actually had a chance to shoot 4x5 for the first time.
His large format Cherry.
Yes, and a quick background, and for those who have followed my work over the years, I've been basically a 35mm and 6x6 kind of guy, especially TLRs. And, of course, my brother, Alex... not our Alex, but my brother Alex. He said, yeah, Bill, you got to get in the 4x5. You got to get in the 4x5. So this August, James said, hey, I got a spare Graflex Speed Graphic. Do you want to try it out? I got a couple of sheets of Foma Pan 100. Okay, let's give it a go. So I show up at High Park for the lug around walk. Of course, I brought my Mamiya C220 with me, which is not exactly light, but more portable. And I shot a frame. I don't know. I'm generally a very patient man. But yeah, I just don't have the patience for 4x5. Just like, oh, wow. Yeah, no. I'm not disputing you're going to get amazing negs out of it. And yeah, I appreciate the craft that goes into it. But just not for me.
Well, it isn't for everyone, and for many, many years I was like, nope, I'm not going to 4x5, I'm not going large format. And then I found a really good deal on a heavily modified Speed Graphic at a camera shop in Rochester, and went, yeah, sure.
And what do you think of it?
Oh, I love 4x5, but again, I have to be in the right mood for it. I basically limit when I take out my 4x5. Mm-hmm. In the past, I've taken it on like regular vacations, but never again unless it's an event like photo stock, where that is like the norm, mm-hmm. where people have the large format gear out. But continuing on, studio cameras aren't just monorail. There are several medium format cameras that really shouldn't be taken out of the studio. Now, everyone's heard of the standard sizes for medium format, 6x4.5, 6x6, 6x7, 6x9. But there is one format that sort of sticks between the two, and that's 6x8. Now, if you haven't heard of 6x8 cameras, that's perfectly all right, because until James showed me this beast, I didn't think they existed either. But sure enough, Fuji has a line of medium format cameras that are absolutely spectacular. And one of them is the Fuji GX680. James, thanks. Tell us about this.
Thanks, Alex. And what's that? I think the GX680, you just sit down there, you RZ67, because the new big boy is in town. But before I get into that, you know you have gear acquisition syndrome when you're at your standard, you know, camera swap meet. We call them, there's a group called Camerama that has them up here in Toronto. And I was walking by a table and I saw this monstrosity of a box. And I'm like, what is that? Oh, that's a Fuji GX680. And honestly, I had never heard of it. And I'm not sure if I have any regrets, maybe a few regrets, but I did trade a very mint F3 with a 58 1.2 for this camera. But anyway, I've since reacquired that gear. But this camera is not to be confused with the GW or GA series of a Fuji. It looks nothing like it. In fact, this camera is it's the unicorn, I would say, of medium format cameras. It weighs about 3.7 kilograms. So for the rest of the world that's not on the metric system, that's over 8 pounds of camera. That's with lens and a waist level finder.
It's heavy in any language.
It is very heavy. It's an interesting beast. There are four models of this particular camera. So there's the GX80s 1 through 3, and then there's the GX S series of this camera. So it's the 680S, and I'll explain the differences, the major differences anyway. So the first cameras, the 1s and 2s, they have a special battery power pack on the side, which is powered by NiCad batteries, and you couldn't actually take the batteries out. On the 3 series, you can actually put 6 AA cell batteries in the side of the camera, so it's a lot more versatile, because the problem is with the older cameras, once those NiCad batteries wear out or they start to corrode or whatever, you have to do some surgery and hopefully be good with a solder iron, go buy yourself some replacement NiCad or nickel metal hydride cells, which would probably be today's standard, and then rebuild that pack yourself. With the 3... it has it takes AA's, and that powers the winder and the body. There are two CR123s inside the body as well to power it, and a CR123 in every film pack. So it is a power-hungry beast. Yes, it does not belong in the field, but the image quality on this camera is just insane. So the main difference between the non-S version and anybody looking for one of these, the S stands for stop, don't buy me, because I suck. So, and the reason is with the S, the front standard is completely static. So for those that don't know, this has a fully functional, it's a bellows focus. And you don't, there's a knob, you focus it on a slide at the bottom, so it's very, on rails at the bottom, so it's very similar to a large format camera. It has a fully articulating front standard, so it's slide, tilt, swing, everything, rise, fall, so you can do everything you want to do with a large format setup, but only on a front standard. The camera's interesting. As far as the body goes, the body only controls the shutter speed. Aperture and depth of field preview are on the side of the lenses. And I have four lenses for this camera on the table here. And the lenses, like, this stuff is just not portable. Like, you know, the lenses are bulky, heavy. The whole camera is, it's a behemoth. One odd thing about this camera, it has lugs for a camera strap.
I find a very ironic for a studio-focused camera.
Yes, and it's interesting. You know, there's a group in Toronto, there's a group of photographers, and I found this a few years ago on YouTube that took the GX683 out on a street shoot in Kensington Market, and they were articulating the camera, and they got some amazing results. So I have handheld this with, I use my Hasselblad strap because it fits the lugs, and my Hassie strap is big and wide enough to support the thing. And I did price out. I saw on eBay the OEM strap for this thing, $340 for a strap. I was like, yeah, that's about $339 too much than I'm willing to pay. So,
what was it? A body harness?
Yeah. No, it was probably a few visits to the chiropractor thrown in. But it's an amazing camera. It comes standard with a waist level finder. There is a metered prism available for this camera, but they are so rare. I have seen a few of them on various worldwide eBay sites, so not the Canadian or eBay US, but eBay Japan or UK sometimes have them, and you're looking minimum $2,200-$2,300 for aperture priority AE finder. Yeah. And what's strange is there is some exposure functionality in this camera. So the body itself has a light meter, and what it does is regardless of what finder's on there, so if you have just the standard non-metered waist level finder, if you under or overexpose by two stops, it beeps at you twice. So it tells you, so, hey, you screwed that shot up, mister. But, you know, a very helpful camera, yes, you know, yeah. But it's pretty incredible. Those that are interested in, I'm sure we'll have some pictures of it in the show notes. Those are interested in finding out more about it. There's a Facebook page that is dedicated as a private Facebook page. We can put the name for those that are interested in the show notes that is completely dedicated to this camera. And when I was researching this, I literally just found this two nights ago. So, you know, I've just recently been added to that group and I've been checking it out. And, the cool thing about the camera is the back rotates as well, so it's like an RB, it's just like an RB that you know, stayed for seconds at Thanksgiving. So it has the bellows are changeable, so you can extend the rails at the bottom depending on your focal length.
Right.
And so you can get the long bellows, and you can get two versions of bag bellows. So you can get short bag bellows, and you can get regular bag bellows. You can also get a looped chimney finder for shooting macro. So if you can imagine macro on a 6x8 negative, it's pretty incredible. And I have on my Pentax 67-2, I have a 1-to-1 life-size filter, and on a 6x7 negative, it's amazing. So just imagine, you know, you get that one extra centimeter, you know, six more square centimeters, lots of fun. So,
how much would something like that go for?
You know what? Surprisingly, it's not that expensive to get into. So I got this kit. He was listing it for $800 when I bought it, and it came with just the body, waist level finder, one back, and I think it was a 135. 5.6, okay. Which is a basic lens for this. I subsequently found a group in Toronto, guys that like were getting rid of this gear. So the lenses are dirt cheap. So I have a 150, 4.5, an 85.6, and a 183.2. And the last two, the shorter 80 and the 180, I think I paid about $120 US. Per lens on eBay, because they're just in North America, they seem to be unpopular and very scarce. They're all over eBay Japan to get into the camera, and it varies, right? I think, you know what, used gear, the demand for used gear is going up so much. So, you know, I think probably if you're looking at a, you know, in a good to excellent kind of condition for one of these things, you're probably going to get into at least $1,500 US.
And that doesn't include the physiotherapy or the Percocets.
No, no. But when you put it next to your pillow and you roll over and you look at it, you feel good about yourself.
That's right.
Yes. Did I say that out loud?
It's still cheaper than a Rolleiflex 6008, that's for certain.
Yeah. True, and yeah, and it's still cheaper than a Contiflex, or a Contax 645.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, by a lot.
By a lot. And the image quality is spectacular on this. At F-16 is like shooting, say, at like F2.8 on a 35mm on this thing. Mm-hmm. And it's an incredible piece of heavy machinery. It's like almost the Japanese consulted the Russians when they said, let's design something that is incredibly heavy and bulky, but produces really great images. So
the Japanese getting back at the Americans.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, it does have a hot shoe, or a cold shoe, rather. I have no idea what the sync speed of this thing is, but just for some effect, here's what the shutter sounds like. What a lovely sound.
Oh, absolutely. And what I really like about this camera, and I have had the chance to shoot it, I shot some Ilford Pan F in it, and the image quality, I can say, is just phenomenal. I would compare it to what I get at a 4x5 cameras, mostly because a lot of the lenses you can stop all the way down to f45, and with the movements and just the general size of the negative, it's enjoyable. As a camera designed for the studio out in the field, I mean, my musket is a little easier to carry, and it's heavier.
It shoots too, right?
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. It is
beautiful. It is. It is quite a stunning thing, and it's when you suffer from the amount of gas that I do, you really like shiny things. So I have a problem.
First step is admitting it.
No, is it?
That's what I've heard. First step is admitting it and
liking it.
Liking it that I'm not sure. I don't think there's any help.
As
for
I
you
like
then.
To coin gear acquisition syndrome, there is no cure, only temporary remission.
Yep,
perfect.
We'll go with that.
Perfect. It does work, yeah.
And the smallest camera on the table today, and that's saying something, is the Mamiya RZ67. This camera is a cinder block that takes beautiful photos, and this particular one belongs to John. Again, this is a camera I've had the joy of shooting, and I really enjoyed it, but it just should not be taken out of the studio.
Thanks, Alex. Yep. So I'll be talking about the RZ, or in Canada we say the RZ. B stood for revolving back. I'm not sure what the Z stands for, revolving marketing department, perhaps. Anyway, I was also at the large format meetup last week, and Bill was saying earlier in the show about how this wasn't his thing, and I've come to the conclusion that 4x5 is not my thing either. It was the back pain leaning over, even with a magnifying glass, I was really having trouble with the ground glass, especially with an old lens. So I'm sort of out of the 4x5 game now. But the thing about the RZ67 is that, to me, it sort of encourages the same kind of shooting. It's not a fast camera. There are people who shoot these without a tripod. I call them crazy. It has a beautiful finder. The focusing experience is lovely, but it's right side up. It's still laterally reversed, but it's right side up. And Mamiya made some beautiful lenses. The RB and RZ kits tend to be fairly low priced in the market. Mamiya gear tends to be, very, very affordable until you get to the Mamiya 6s and Mamiya 7s, which are the unobtainium ones. But something like this, especially, you can also use the RB lenses, like the lenses that were made for the RB series on the RZ. The reverse does not work because the RZ lenses depend on the camera, the RZ body, for shutter speed control. Right. But the reverse is true, and you can get RB glass very, very inexpensively, like fine lenses for under $100. Yeah. And so for me, again, it is not a light camera. I thought today, okay, I'll put this big beast on the table and it will just dominate. And then in came the Fuji. So this one's just going to sort of crawl away into the corner now because it feels like a compact. But the lens I do have on it is a 75 millimeter perspective control. And it's a big lens. Like it's the same length as the body, and it is as heavy.
I think it's bigger.
Yeah, it could be. Well, it's pretty close.
Yeah.
So it's an amazing camera, but yeah, I don't take it out as often as I should because I know at the end of the day my back will be screaming at me.
The one problem I found with at least the RB67 was that to get it ready to shoot again, it's a two-step process, right? You advance the film, and then you cock the shutter in the body. And again, it's no different from shooting 4x5 where you pull out the dark slide, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But even that seems easier to me.
The RZ, that's one of the improvements they made. Is that it's a single step now.
Beautiful.
A single stroke. However, there's still, let's say if you're setting up for testing or multiple exposures, there's a little switch you can set, and then you can instantly forget it and say, okay, I just shot 8 of the most beautiful pictures I've ever done. How come the back says I'm on shot 2? And then I go bang my head against nearest concrete wall. So like a lot of the larger gear, I think it really expects photographers to pay attention to what they're doing, and it will punish you for being sloppy and unfocused.
Yep. Well, just like any camera of this nature, right? It's not 35 millimeter.
Exactly.
Right. And you shouldn't shoot it like 35 millimeter. You can and get beautiful images out of it, but you slip up and you'll pay. So
your back will pay.
Yes. Now, one developer that we have just started exploring, and I know Mike, James, and I have all used it and absolutely love it, is one that Mike pointed us in the direction of, and that's Spur HRX. Now, if you haven't heard of Spur HRX, don't worry about it. Not many people have. And it's an odd one in the sense that, like Pyro developer, that comes in a Part A and Part B, but unlike Pyro, it's just a single dilution developer. And to give us a little background on Spur HRX, Mike.
Well, I happened to come across it. There was a gentleman in the U.S., Larry Dressler. I had asked him about it, and he said that he's been really, really wanting to try it, but it's not an inexpensive developer, say like HD110 or D76, but I thought, you know what, why not? I want to try it. I want to see what I can get out of it. And needless to say, I bit the bullet, spent the money, bought the developer, and it was probably not a good idea because I have pretty much gotten hooked on it. I know James is pretty hooked on it.
Damn you, Mike.
Especially with Acris, which he is hoarding. But I find that pretty much any film I've developed with this has given me phenomenal results. I mean, I've done FomaPan 200, and I'm not talking about the standard stills version. I'm talking about the surveillance film version, which is a little more grainy. It's not quite the same formulation, but I still really like the results that I got out of it, and I find that this developer gives you really, really sharp images, similar to that of Rodinal, but the grain, it's a very, very fine grain, almost like, I'd almost say it's similar to like almost like a mix of HD110 and T-Max developer.
Okay, I'm a guy who loves HD110, Xtol, D76, etc. and so forth. I've been trying to wrap my brain around this. How does it all work? Like, walk me through if I'm just doing a single roll 35 mil in, say, a Patterson tank.
Okay, so in a Patterson tank, I'd say it's about 450 milliliters of solution.
500.
Okay, 500. That makes it pretty easy, actually. So you've got a Part A and a Part B, and Part A and Part B never meet until the moment that you're going to actually process your film. So you take your standard dilution, let's say it was a 1 to 10, just to make it easy, which would make it about 50 mils of chemical that you'd need. So you take that 50, split it in half, and so 25 milliliters of part A, 25 milliliters of part B, mix them together in your cylinder, add the water to bring it up to 500, you're good to go. That's it.
The trouble is when you start getting half milliliter, when you start cutting it in half. So what I've basically been doing is I've been generally adjusting the film speeds to match dilutions that give me that nice even split. So I've used it in Spur HRX with my personal favorite film, Kodak Tri-X, Ilford FP4, and Delta 100, and it Tri-X, I'll like Tri-X in almost everything. You could soup Tri-X in Caffeinol, and I'll think it's the best thing ever. Delta 100, again, another film that I really like, and it's just a slight pull to 80, and it just sings in 120 and 35 millimeter. And FP4, I just think is, again, one of the best films ever, and you just pull it again just slightly to 100. And in Spur HRX, and again, it is sharp as anything. I would, again, like I said before, this is the closest thing to being a pyro developer without being a pyro developer, because you get that sharpness of Rodinal, but the fine grain nature that you'd find in like Xtol or Microdol X.
Yeah, I agree. I think I've developed Akros, and I love the combination of Spur and Akros. It's incredible. I have souped some Polypan in it as well. And Polypan, the contrast with the highlights on Polypan are amazing with this developer as well. Yeah, where it gets a little bit tricky is, you know, you need a calculator sometimes and a sick kid at home so you can steal one of their medicine droppers. Yep. Because a lot of the times it's 1 to 17 mixing ratio. So, you know, it's half milliliters here and there, but you know, it's not that big of a deal. But what I find in particular, whether or not it's a cubic grained emulsion or a T-grain emulsion, the edge sharpness or accutance and the sort of buttery mid-tone that you get out of this developer is, I haven't seen it in anything from an HC110 or an Xtol. You're right. It's a combo of it's almost like a refined Rodinal.
Yeah, yeah. That's a really good way to look at it.
So, are there any online resources that we could refer to for Spur?
I haven't come across any myself.
And the ones I've come across are all in German.
Oh, jeez.
That would make sense.
No, I don't speak German, unfortunately.
And Spur, by the way, stands for Speed Photography Ultra High Resolution.
Mm-hmm.
It comes in a very German package, a very utilitarian plastic bag.
Yep.
And a one sheet of instructions that's half German, half English. So, mm-hmm.
And that is, again, another drawback of this developer is that it's hard to get in North America. We source ours from Argentix, and it's often in stock in small quantities, and then it's gone.
Because James buys it.
Well.
Or Mike. So you know who to blame.
Blame Donna. Blame Donna.
That about wraps it up for this show. I hope everyone hasn't gotten the idea that they need to go out and buy any of these cameras. But if you do, don't blame us. It's not our fault. It's your own.
This is John Meadows. Remember, if you're lugging around a large view camera, it helps to have a great ass. I mean donkey. I mean mule.
In front of you?
That Possibly. Too.
Yeah.
This is Donna Pataxi. Keep that film rolling and try 4x5.
This is Mike Pataxi, and if you walk around with an 8x10 monorail for a while, you probably will have a nice ass. Oh, wait, I said that out loud.
This is Bill Smith. I've decided I'm traveling light.
This is Alex Lokes, and I'm glad I have a good drug plan through work.
This is James Lee. What the F-stop? Did you see the size of that?